Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When it was first created 50 years ago, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, was devoted solely to protecting Western Europe from attack from the forces of the Soviet Union. With the end of the Cold War, that mission has changed significantly. NATO expanded to Eastern Europe, back to the very doorstep of Russia, and today is involved in peacekeeping in Africa, military operations in Afghanistan, troop training in Iraq, and terrorist interdiction in the Mediterranean. How successful have these operations been? Well, my guest today has been a critic of U.S. interventions that do not involve vital American interests. Dr. Rajan Menon is a professor of international relations at the City College of New York. He's been a fellow at the Carnegie Council on Ethics and International Affairs and the New America Foundation, an academic fellow at the Carnegie Corporation, research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the author of several books, including most recently Conflict in Ukraine, The Unwinding of the Post-Cold War Order, and The Conceit of Humanitarian Intervention. He's written for a number of publications, including most recently for The Nation magazine. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. Rajan Menon, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Pleasure to be here.
You spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations about the track record and increasing reach of NATO's interventions. You know, NATO was created as an organization basically designed to protect Western Europe from outside attack. NATO is now conducting operations, by my count, on three continents. So what is the track record of this increasing mission creep and increasing interventions?
So just a little bit of background, and I'll be brief. NATO, during the Cold War, had a very clear mission. It was to counter the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet-led alliance. When the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a question of, well, what is the purpose of NATO now? Because Russia was not seen as the adversary. The Cold War was over. Russia was referred to as a partner. So it began to expand in Europe. Now, the rationale for that was then, because there was no threat, the Russian economy was collapsing, the Russian military was collapsing, that we wanted to spread democracy to the alliance. Now, the interesting thing is, if you wanted to do that, the logical candidate in terms of democratizing the prize would have been Russia. That created a conflict between us and Russia, expansion. But they did something else called out-of-area expansion. NATO would not just operate in Europe anymore. It would go engage in conflict resolution, humanitarian intervention, peacekeeping in a whole variety of areas. Senator Richard Lugar, one of the Senate's foreign policy experts at the time, said, NATO either will go out of area or out of business. So that is how we got to the place that you just described, where NATO has gone out of area, not offering memberships to states outside Europe, but engaging in Kosovo-like interventions, or Bosnia, which was not a NATO operation per se, but NATO participated. Libya was not a NATO intervention per se, but major NATO countries participated. So you're correct. There is activity on a wide front.
Well, today, from NATO's own webpage, it's six different interventions of varying sizes. Afghanistan is the one most of us all know about. Still, there are peacekeeping forces in Kosovo.
Yes.
There are naval forces in the Mediterranean looking at indicting terrorist activity in the sea and along the coastlines. There's a training mission in Iraq. We're supporting the African Union in Somalia for various peacekeeping operations there and operations. And then we have an air policy in Ukraine.
Yes.
So I know you spoke on the track record of these interventions. What is the track record in your view?
Well, I think it's kind of mixed. So let's take Bosnia, for example. The bombing in 95 did end the war. But between 92 and 95, as you well know, 300,000 people were killed and the world stood by. And there were serious questions about NATO. Well, you set out of area operations. This seems like a classic one. But the fact of the matter is nobody was particularly interested in getting involved, least of all putting in ground troops. There was, as you know, a UN peacekeeping mission in Bosnia at the time called UNPROFOR. But you know what happened during its tenure. The Serbs ran amok and took all kinds of safe areas declared by Bosnia. Now, there's a connection between Bosnia and Kosovo. The Kosovar rebellion against the Serbs began in, well, it has a long history, but it started kicking up into high gear in 98, led by the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army. They were an armed insurgent group. NATO intervened much more quickly, I think partly because of Bosnia, because they had realized that they stood on the sidelines in Bosnia and had to do something. But of course, again, nobody wanted to put ground troops down. So the campaign against the Serbs was waged from the air. The expectation was that the Serbs would fold in about 3 days. The air campaign lasted 78 days. And NATO was so careful that not a single pilot be harmed that pilots were ordered to stay above 25,000 feet, which meant that they couldn't really see Serb armor on the ground. Now, the effect of that was in the 78-day period, five times as many people were killed than the preceding year. And it was the killings of the preceding year that led to the intervention itself. Now, in both Kosovo and Bosnia, you could say, well, there was success. But there's been a prolonged peacekeeping operation, as you pointed out. Kosovo is still continuing. Bosnia kind of wound up. So the question I ask is, how many such interventions, given the effort that is required, can NATO carry out, especially because very few countries have the military wherewithal? There's the United States, there's Britain, and there's France, and that's pretty much it. You think Germany, but the German parliament recently did a report on the state of the German army, and it's worth reading. It's not very flattering.
So beyond Kosovo, yeah. When you look at Afghanistan, you look at some of these other missions.
Yes.
Do you feel like they're overreached by NATO and there should be a reevaluation of what NATO is really about?
I think there needs to be a much clearer mission. And I have sympathy for NATO to this extent. The Cold War, it had a very clear mission. It had a bumper sticker. And I was saying the other day that if you had to write the bumper sticker, it would be something like this. NATO existed during the Cold War to deter and, if essential, to defeat a Soviet intervention. Now, if I ask anybody, give me a bumper sticker today for NATO, they would hem and haw and they wouldn't be clear. So that tells you something. The other thing is that it's expanded from, it was, you know, founded by roughly 12 countries. At the height of the Cold War, it had 16. Now it has 29. The larger the number, the more difficult it is to get a consensus on these operations. That's number one. Number two, and you've seen this under Trump, the more a dispute begins on burden sharing. Why are some countries doing the heavy lifting and others are not, even though they say that they're in imminent danger against the Russians? So I think you're going to see much more of this. What Trump has done, and he's done it in a very public and kind of ham-handed way, perhaps, but I think it's been a long time coming, this dispute on burden sharing.
In 2008, you wrote a book titled The End of Alliances, which urged the U.S. to reevaluate all its commitments to Cold War alliances. That not only includes NATO, but it also includes Japan and Korea.
Correct.
Of course, a lot has changed in the past 12 years, now almost 12 years now. But should we still be reevaluating these alliances, or have things changed enough to the point where we need to leave things as they are?
You know, this is a very good question. And I will say that when I wrote the book, I did not foresee the significant degree to which China would be a formidable military power. They were on the way up, but they have now changed the name of the game. So what I would say now, the end of alliances, by the way, is a kind of a provocative title, and I wasn't talking about literally abolishing them. But I wanted to ask the question, now that the Cold War has ended, and you take, say, the European Union, it has a GDP roughly comparable to ours. It is the second most important center of economic activity in the world. Technologically and scientifically, they have the wherewithal. They are maybe not on par with us, but they give us a good run for our money. I want somebody to explain to me why it is that a group of countries like that cannot articulate a defense strategy and an effective means of defense for itself. That doesn't mean one has to be an isolationist, because we and the Europeans will be tied together in many, many different ways. But I think it's important for Europe to take a greater role. I think the same thing about Japan. They spend about 0.9% on their GDP. People say, well, we can't have them spend more because then they'll go hog wild like they did in the 30s. But I tell them the choice is not between the status quo and militarism. I don't think anybody seriously thinks that the Japanese are going to go run amok like they did in the 30s, but they can certainly do more in their own defense. Here's the thing. They have to do it because the risk that we have to now incur to defend our commitments in Asia because of how powerful the Chinese have become is much greater. So if I were a Japanese, I would say, how much will the Americans bleed for me when push comes to shove? And so in Japanese self-interest, if I may speak for them for a moment, I don't presume to, I would be really thinking about it. Now, under Prime Minister Abe, I think there's an understanding of this, but he has to be very careful because there is a very strong legacy in Japan of keeping your head low. But partly that legacy has been allowed to keep alive because you had Uncle Sam. You had a defense problem. It's 1-800-UNCLE-SAM.
Well, getting back to Europe for a moment, you know, you're talking about why can't they come up with a common defense strategy. they, you know, the European Union, the political side of the NATO alliance, can't come up with the
yes.
You know, they're seeing incredible strains on
absolutely
on the relationship as it exists now, much less trying to take it forward to a common currency.
Absolutely.
You know, to some sort of united Europe.
Right. But, you know, if you look at the long haul, Rich, the interesting thing about Europe is that before 1945, for 500 years, it was the place where people were slaughtering each other the most. It was the scene of horrific warfare. Come the EU, NATO, Marshall Plan, Europe has become kind of a peace community. And they did some remarkable things. Common tariff, abolishing internal tariffs, a currency where countries actually gave up currencies, the French franc, for example, the Dutch guilder, lots of other things. And there's a European identity that has emerged. If you ask a lot of people in different countries, the concept of Europeanness, even now with the populist and nationalist backlash, is alive and well. So I think it's possible to have a more serious discussion about a defense strategy. You are absolutely right that now the landscape has changed and the lift would be much heavier. There's no question about that.
You mentioned China's growing military prowess. We also have a Russia that is looking back to its former empire, if you will, and longingly made territorial gains in the southern part of its area in the Ukraine, heading westward. Is that something to be very concerned about to a revival of that traditional rivalry between East and West?
Well, I can tell you that if you go to the Baltic provinces, the Baltic republics, excuse me, or to Ukraine, the Baltics, of course, in NATO, Ukraine is not, would dearly like to be, there is a great concern. And I understand that concern. But I also think that the expansion of NATO was carried forth in a way that paid absolutely no attention at all to how the Russians perceived it. And we didn't understand why they would be mystified that an alliance that symbolized Cold War rivalry, the Warsaw Pact having been gone and only NATO was left standing, that the expansion toward their borders would be mystifying to them when we were telling them the Cold War is over, Russia is a partner. And people have this mistaken view that it's all Vladimir Putin, that he's the one who's cranked this up. But in point of fact, Gorbachev, the last president of the Soviet Union, Yeltsin in the 90s, and Putin, none of them wanted this because they couldn't understand why their security concerns would not be taken into account. So let me give you kind of a thought experiment. Imagine that it had gone the other way around and they won the Cold War. And they said to us, you know, the Warsaw Pact is going to expand it towards your hemisphere, and we're going to offer membership first to Guatemala and then Costa Rica, and then we're thinking about Mexico. But you know us, we're Russians, we always mean well, we love you Americans. Would we have tolerated that for a minute? We absolutely would not have. So I think in some sense, now I'm not arguing that everything that Putin has done, everything that's going on in Russia is our fault. That is not at all what I'm saying. I think that unless you take into account the adversary's history and the adversary's perceptions, the Russian view, I think, is in the 90s, we were in a state of collapse and we were called partners and our democratization was welcomed. But in the process, this expansion was done. And people who really knew Russia, like the late George Kennan or Richard Pipes, who was a conservative and didn't have any illusions about Russia, but knew Russian history, they both warned against the backlash. But there were powerful constituencies here in the foreign policy establishment that were determined to do this.
Well, let's go back to the other side of the ocean, and that would be the emergence of China, and especially in its assertions in the South China Sea. Does this change the way we should be viewing those traditional partners that the United States has had?
Yes. So the interesting question is, do you want to have a relationship with Russia that pushes them into the arms of China at a time when China is going to be your major adversary? It's not going to be Russia. To the extent that there is a power on the horizon that can compete with the U.S. for dominance first in Asia and maybe in the rest of the world, it is China. So let's take Taiwan and South Korea and Japan. 30 years ago, the United States dominated that region. In a force-on-force confrontation with the Chinese in the South China Sea now, I think we would still prevail. But the risk that we would have to take because of the weapons they've acquired largely from Russia, by the way, and also have developed the indigenous capability to develop because they have economically grown by leaps and bounds and money is no object. The Chinese are a formidable military force, and they practice something called area denial. That is, they want to make it very hard for an outside force, and you know which outside force they have in mind, to penetrate the South China Sea, which they see as an expansion of their, I mean, their official position is they pretty much own all of the South China Sea. Now, I think that's a debatable question, but there's no question that they have, that is their strategy.
It would be, is it comparable to our Gulf of Mexico?
Well, to this extent, you know, we like to say, or Angela Merkel, I believe it was, somebody who said, well, spheres of influence are so 19th century, it's passé. I don't believe that for a second. Countries have spheres of influence. I think we regard certain regions as our sphere of influence. We wouldn't tolerate it. We haven't since the 19th century, the Monroe Doctrine and so on. I think the Russians believe they're entitled to a sphere of influence. You and I might not like it, and we may not agree on the terms, but reality is reality. And the Chinese absolutely, certainly do.
My guest today is Dr. Rajan Menon. He's a professor of international relations at the City College of New York. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. His most recent book is actually on a different subject, The Conceit of Humanitarian Intervention, although this does sort of get back to the idea of what should NATO be doing and what shouldn't NATO be doing. And I want to talk a little bit about that book. The book seemed to note the increase in military interventions and campaigns against mass killings that have occurred in the last 20, 25 years, really since the end of the Cold War, in areas around the world. And it tackles this belief that there is a united international community that is an agreement that the community should always intervene when you have these issues. And you argue not that we shouldn't intervene, but that's not the case, that we have a united international community on this. And I think you can look at any nation that's been involved in some of these humanitarian and military interventions for cases where they didn't step in because they didn't deem it to be in their national interest.
Correct. So Exhibit A, to prove the point that you just made of not stepping in, is Rwanda. You know that between in 3 months in 1994, between 800,000 Rwandans, overwhelmingly Tutsi but also Hutu. The Tutsis were the minority and the Rwandan Hutus were the majority. And there was a battle between the two about who would rule the country. Nobody stepped in. Nobody wanted to step in. Now, some people have argued that genocide happened so quickly, a million people in 3 months. It scaled up so fast. Nobody saw it coming, that nothing could be done. First, it's not true that nobody saw it coming because there was a UN peacekeeping force, a very inadequate one, I might say, precisely because they were worried that it was coming because the Rwandan government was kind of coerced into signing a power-sharing agreement with the Tutsi insurgents that they didn't much like. But the more interesting thing is this. It may have been that nobody could have done anything. It was unfolding too quickly, but no one was planning. There was no discussion about it. Nobody was even seriously discussing, well, should we make some preparations? So that's one example.
Do you think that is because there's two explanations. One is going to race.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The second would be Africa, and that part of Africa is a diplomatic international backwater.
Yes.
I mean, that's the more easy answer.
No, I think those are two very good points. I think it is probably true that the two combined, but the problem is that if you say out of area means that NATO and the rest of the international community has embraced the norm that governments cannot, in the name of sovereignty, slaughter their people, then you have to decide what does this norm mean if in some of the most egregious cases, nothing is done. You could argue on the basis of kind of pragmatic realpolitik considerations, well, we didn't have any dog in that fight, so to speak, or there were no interests involved there. But that's not the basis on which the norm of humanitarian intervention is predicated. It is that there is an ethical obligation that in the post-Cold War era, where liberalism is triumphant, or so we thought, it's a little arguable now, that NATO and the international community had to do this. I will say, within the international community, there's much more division about the circumstances under which state sovereignty may be breached. So the Russians and the Chinese have a very different attitude. I would say the Indians have a very different attitude. The Brazilians were in favor, but after the Libya intervention, they were not quite so sure. And then there's one other thing, which is proven by Libya. You can cut the head of a government off, but are you prepared to deal with the aftermath? And if you don't, you'll get Libya. Two governments, a military strongman, 30 militias, criminal syndicates, human trafficking, refugees using Libya as a jumping-off point to go to Europe and then triggering the rise of nationalist movements. And Libya has become not only a dangerous place in itself, it's become dangerous to the entire swath of North Africa. And Samantha Power, President Obama's advisor at the time and a big proponent of humanitarian intervention, has written a book that will be prominently displayed in bookstores, I'm sure, where she says, well, you know, people blame us for Libya, but we couldn't possibly have foreseen it. My goodness, I mean, we just had the incident of Iraq where we did exactly this and where there was chaos, and a responsible government official would have to say, now, what if things don't work out the way we do? What is our plan B? Well, the answer was there was no plan B.
That was your most recent book, The Conceit of Humanitarian Intervention. I know you're working on a new piece on what could be perhaps the newest destabilizer between the great powers, and that is a class of weapons called hypersonic missiles, which I haven't really heard a whole lot about.
So I have two aspects of my career. One is the academic scholarly stuff, and the other are writing for very informed, well-educated people who are on top of the news. And there is a large readership of people out there. Hypersonic missiles, a missile is classified, or a weapon, as hypersonic, which could be an aircraft. The X-15 back in the day, in the 60s, I'm old enough to remember, was hypersonic. Once you cross Mach 5, five times the speed of sound, you are in the hypersonic class.
And what about your traditional ICBMs? Don't they become hypersonic, or are they just below that?
Well, the warheads can sometimes become hypersonic as they close in. But the thing about a hypersonic weapon is there are two things that make them very difficult to defend against. First, Mach 5 is a threshold, but now we have weapons that can go potentially, they say, as high as Mach 20. So it compresses decision time. What is coming at me? Who's fired it? How do I respond? If I don't respond, will I lose my own military assets? Imagine a situation where the United States and China are headed to a crisis. We have our carrier battle groups steaming toward their coast. They have warned us not to intervene. We both have hypersonic systems. Will there be a temptation, because both sides fear the other side might use first, to use it? Let's take another example. The INF Treaty, which banned intermediate range nuclear forces in Europe, that was signed in 87 between us and the Soviets, is now dead. We've walked away from it. I'm not sure what the Russians really thought about that. Some say they didn't want it either. It doesn't matter. It's gone. Imagine a situation where in Europe, both we and the Russians put intermediate nuclear weapons back, but this time they are hypersonic weapons. Same deal. Hypersonic weapons are difficult to intercept for another reason. It's not just speed. It's that they maneuver in flight. So they can change their flight
path. Like a cruise missile.
Yes.
Except at hypersonic speeds.
So they're hypersonic cruise missiles and they're hypersonic glide vehicles. A cruise missile is like a pilot's aircraft. It flies really low, below the radar cross-section of most radars. And of course, in the case of a hypersonic missile, they're flying at Mach 5, Mach 10, something like that. A glide vehicle is something different. It's boosted up on a rocket, but it doesn't follow what's called a parabolic trajectory. So imagine a big inverted U. Right. It has a much lower trajectory. And it releases the rocket releases the glide vehicle, and the glide vehicle then begins to move toward its target with onboard sensors and so on. So those are the two things. I mean, this is the kind of new kid on the block in terms of arms races. And the question is, do we have arms control treaties? Do we have talks ongoing?
Do we have any discussions beginning on this?
Yes, but often, you know, technology marches way ahead of politics. And so this is a classic example of that.
Are there discussions going between some of the great powers?
Not to the best of my knowledge. Everyone's busy deploying it because they don't want the other guy to deploy first. And I understand that, but that is the entire logic of arms races. So I would say if there's a cutting edge of the coming arms race, this is the new kid on the block.
This won't be big, huge missiles anymore. This will be fairly small, probably portable.
Correct. One other thing, you know, so far our hypersonic program, as best I understand it, is geared toward conventional non-nuclear warheads. The Chinese and Russians, it's less clear. So now if we have a new nuclear arms control treaty, it can't be just between us and the Russians. We've got to fold the Chinese in. And how do we deal with the hypersonic thing? So things have become much more complicated. But of course, everything is kind of frozen now because we're not having in discussions with the Russians. We haven't brought the Chinese into the nuclear arms control regime. And the old Cold War formula of just a dyad, us and the Russians, is not useful anymore.
And it's probably not useful even between three powers, I mean, because we have a lot of nuclear powers.
Correct.
Now.
I mean, imagine India and Pakistan, given what's going on in Kashmir, now both deploying hypersonic weapons. The Indians have an active program. The Pakistanis, I don't think so. But, you know, technology morphs and spreads, and eventually people will want hypersonic weapons, and some states will be willing to sell it for them. The Indian hypersonic weapons programs owes itself significantly to collaboration with the Russians.
My guest today is Dr. Rajan Menon. He's a professor of international relations at the City College of New York. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week. He spends a lot of time looking at international threats, international alliances, and the like. But for an international scholar, you also write a lot about domestic policy, especially in the past year. You've been writing for The Nation on the opioid crisis, suicide rates, economic inequality, and poverty within the United States. What has led to this particular writing?
So what's led to this is a conception of national security that we have, and we're not unique in this, other countries do as well, that is overly militarized and focuses on external threats. But if you think of the day-to-day things that Americans are insecure about, it is, will their paycheck go far enough? Will a single mother be able to get childcare so she can work? What are people saving for retirement? If you look at the average savings in the below the median, the bottom 50% of earners, you'll be shocked of how little people have got. Very often companies are hiring people as contract workers and not giving them insurance. The opioid crisis. We've lost in the opioid crisis more people than we lost in pretty much all of our post-Cold War wars combined. And then there's economic inequality. And so Donald Trump can be explained in many, many ways. And I did not vote for him, but I give him credit for this. He was able to put together a narrative that stitched together people's being fed up with the forever wars, wars that never end abroad, and a sense that the system was broken and that it was rigged by an elite and an establishment. I myself believe that President Trump is part of that elite, part of that establishment, no matter what he might say. But he kind of, as European populists have done, projected himself as a break-the-system kind of guy because the system isn't working for you. And I think when you look at all these problems that we've talked about and you visit parts of the country like Tulsa, I think you find a fair number of people who feel that things are not working out for them, that day-to-day security or insecurity is not part of the national security debate. A suicide epidemic, I mean, we have a huge epidemic. You don't hear of it very much. You know, I spent a couple of years working on the New York City suicide hotline, and I know something about this up close and personal. Last year, I think it was, 47,000 people who took their lives. So this is very serious, and I'm interested in this, and journalism gives me an opportunity to explore.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you so much.
Dr. Rajan Menon is a professor of international relations at the City College of New York. He's the author of the 2016 book, The Conceit of Humanitarian Intervention, and he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week, speaking on NATO Goes Global, A Look at the Record. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent programs, they're available online to listen to on demand anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.